Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Sunday in Las Vegas, in less than 12 minutes, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock shot and killed 59 people and injured more than 500. So here we are having yet another conversation about guns, legislation, and the gun lobby. Here are some facts that we need to know. The number of firearms in the United States has steadily increased over the past two decades, according to the New York Times. In 1994, there were 192 million guns. Today, there are 310 million. Just 3% of adults own half of the nation's firearms, according to the results of a Harvard Northeastern survey of 4,000 gun owners. Since 1994, gun homicides have fallen dramatically. They've fallen, while the number of mass shootings has spiked. Again, this is according to the New York Times. There have now been 338 mass shootings in just 278 days in the United States, and that means more than four people have been killed. On average, there's more than one mass shooting for every single day in this country. Over 30,000 people die of gun violence in the U.S. every year. According to research from the Harvard Business School, 56% are suicides, 40% are homicides, and 4% are accidents. Guns are responsible for the deaths or injury of over 7,000 children in the United States every year. And now a few facts about lobbying and profits. In 2015, according to IBIS World, annual revenue of the gun and ammunition manufacturing industry was $13.5 billion. Profits were $1.5 billion. According to Thomson Reuters, shares in gun companies rise after mass shootings. Over the past decade, an investment in a gun company saw a 365% return. And then the NRA. The NRA says it has more than 5 million members. According to Open Secrets, it spent almost $55 million during the last election cycle. $30 million was spent to support Donald Trump. That's more than any other outside group, including the Trump Super PAC, which spent $20 million. According to the Center for Public Integrity, in October alone, about one of every 20 TV ads in Pennsylvania was sponsored by the NRA, and it ran one in nine ads in North Carolina, one of eight in Ohio. So what will it take to convince the Republican Party to take on the NRA? According to stats, about 95% of the NRA's funding goes to Republicans and Republican groups. Today, we are joined by two guests to talk about all of this. Lois Beckett is a senior reporter with The Guardian U.S., where she covers gun policy, criminal justice, and the conservative movement in the U.S. After the Orlando shooting, Lois worked on a five-part series about gun control laws in the U.S. The report is called Can the U.S. Break Its Cycle of Gun Control Failure? And Lois joins us from the Guardian's offices in New York. Hi, Lois. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. That's a grassroots movement of moms fighting for public safety measures that protect people from gun violence. Moms Demand Action has chapters in all 50 states, and it's part of Every Town for Gun Safety, the largest gun violence prevention organization with more than 3 million members. Hi, Shannon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, here we are again talking about guns and the lobby and the NRA. Shannon, do you feel like the conversation's any different this time around?
Yeah, I mean, I have hope. I refuse to be a cynic about this issue. I think every time something like this happens, it's the exact right time to talk about guns in this country, and how incredibly lax our gun laws are and how incredibly high our rate of gun violence is. And so I think that having this conversation is incredibly important. We now have more data, more research that shows us that stronger gun laws do work. And I think it's, you know, it's very telling that the NRA has been completely silent for the last 72 hours. They don't have anything to add to this conversation except the idea that we need more guns and fewer laws. And we know that is a failed experiment in America.
We did invite the NRA to join us. We also invited the top three NRA recipients, Senators John McCain, Richard Burr, and Roy Blunt, and we did not hear back from them. Lois, you extensively report on this issue. Do you feel like the conversation we're having this time around is any different than the last time?
Well, I think it's so interesting to see finally Republicans showing some willingness perhaps to ban some kind of weapon or accessory, and that's banning these bump stocks, which the shooter appeared to have had or used in the Las Vegas shooting. But what's so sad about this is that bump stocks are literally a dangerous toy that a couple gun enthusiasts like to use in YouTube videos. They are not serious. They are not widely spread. So if everything that comes out of this is that Congress is finally willing to pass a law and is to ban a dumb toy that many people think should never have been legal in the first place, that will be so frustrating and so sad.
That's what I was thinking, because today's New York Times front page, top of the fold, says after years of resistance, GOP may back gun control measure. So this is getting headlines. But like you said, a lot of things to many people are no-brainers, but this one is making headlines?
I mean, I think it's hard because people want action and people are so outraged. And after every shooting, there's enough opposition to say that, you know, the status quo is okay, that people can get by and saying we must do something, that saying the words gun control is enough, that saying we must take action is enough, that somehow gets us where we need to be. But it doesn't. We have a lot of guns in this country, and we have to talk realistically about what is possible with different restrictions. Not every gun control law is created equal.
Right. And also the importance of connecting the dots, because I laid out a lot of facts in the intro. I think it's important to look at the profits and the lobbying and how many shootings are happening a day, how many kids are being killed, mass shootings. What does the data tell us? Lois, what are your thoughts on the importance of really connecting all of these dots and not just focusing on one part of this?
I think it's tremendously important. And a lot of the statistics that you shared and that people share seem like they're easy to understand, and they're not. For instance, that statistic that's getting shared so much, that, 338 mass shootings in 200 days in America, it seems that this kind of thing that happens in Las Vegas is happening every day. But if you look at the kind of violence that is sparking these shootings, where more than four more people are shot, actually the circumstances are totally different. The weapons that are used are different. The people who are being targeted are different. And when the New York Times did an analysis of these shootings with multiple victims in 2015, they found that overwhelmingly that these were shootings that were happening in very, very poor neighborhoods of America, with primarily victims of color, getting almost no attention. So that just trying to define things numerically doesn't necessarily tell us what's going to help prevent something. That doing an assault weapon ban is not going to be relevant to the majority of what we're calling these mass shootings in America. And we have to think first, who is being harmed, who can be saved, and work backwards from our understanding of what's actually happening to the policies that we need, rather than working from a headline or from outrage or from what you see on TV to what you think should be done in America.
Shannon, what are your thoughts on this? How do you think we should make sense of all of these statistics that we now have access to?
Yeah, I think Lois is exactly right. The reality is that semi-automatic weapons, so-called assault weapons, are really used in only about 11% of all mass shootings. So in many ways, Las Vegas was an anomaly. In terms of this bump stock prohibition, great. But if that's the only action we take after 58 Americans are shot and killed and hundreds more are injured, we should be ashamed of ourselves. We have seen in states that have gone ahead and closed the private sale loophole, which now is 19 states, and that basically means that you cannot get a gun at a gun show or online without a background check, that these laws work. Stronger laws work across the board. They prohibit women from getting killed by their abusers. They protect police from getting killed by civilians. They reduce the amount of homicides. They even reduce the amount of gun suicides. So there are laws that work, but the NRA is opposed to them. And that is why we're not having that conversation right now, because there are a handful of members of Congress who are completely beholden to the NRA.
Lois, you've done a lot of reporting on this. Can you tell us what the research says about what actually works?
So the research is really complicated, and I think a lot of Americans will say, oh, we need a public health approach to gun violence. But what public health experts actually do is make very tiny tweaks that may be actually kind of laborious to save a very small number of lives and add a lot of these up. And that doesn't fit into an easy slogan. That doesn't easy, it's not easy to make a political campaign on that. Background checks are something that a lot of researchers say would be helpful, but it's not that that's the final policy that's going to get us where we need to go. That researchers said that background checks are kind of like a spine on which you can build other policies that might have a bigger effect. One thing that's really difficult about this debate is that Democrats, when they're introducing laws, will often point to research on actually fairly stringent gun control laws, like a permit to purchase, saying you have to show up at a police department and get a permit there from law enforcement in order to buy a gun. And they will use that to say, oh, we should pass generic background checks, which just means you have to get a background check at a gun store, not that higher level of scrutiny. And then something like what happened after Sandy Hook, the Manchin-Toomey legislation we saw there wasn't even a universal background check. It was expanding background checks slightly on private sales at the internet or at gun shows. So you see this slippage from the things that have the best evidence of working to these political compromises that actually get introduced. And there's a big gap there, and we don't talk about that gap very often.
Shannon, can you talk about that gap?
Again, I think that's exactly right. We have research now, despite the fact that the NRA has put the chill on government research on gun violence prevention. We do know what would save lives. We know that requiring a background check on every single gun sale, we know that laws like domestic gun violence laws that keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers, these laws work, and there is no reason not to implement them. They are not undoing the Second Amendment. They're not about confiscation or registration. They are simply laws that we know work that will reduce the amount of deaths by gun violence in this country. And that is the conversation that we should be having right now.
Shannon Watts is founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, and Lois Beckett is a senior reporter for The Guardian U.S., where she covers gun policy. She wrote a five-part series after the Orlando shooting called Can the U.S. Break Its Cycle of Gun Control Failure? And we wanted to do this show today to talk about what works, what doesn't work, and where we are right now. How did we get here? If you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about the conversation that we're having this time around? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And we recently switched our email account over to yourcall@kalw.org. So if you have a comment, please email yourcall@kalw.org. What do you think about this conversation? What changes would you like to see? And there's so much data out there right now. The New York Times just looked at the top recipients of the NRA's funding and found that the majority are Republicans. Democrats come in around the 40s. So what are your thoughts about that? Lois, you wrote a piece about Nevada. Nevada voters approved a new gun control law, so why was it not enforced? A criminal background check for private sales was blocked just days before it was due to go into effect, which shows the difficulties of passing stricter gun laws. Tell us what happened there.
So because Congress has been so unwilling to pass new gun control legislation, a lot of gun violence prevention advocates are now focusing on the states where they've actually seen some victories. And in the 2016 election, which was a tough day for many in the gun violence prevention movement, Nevada was one of these exceptions where voters very narrowly approved an expansion of background checks so that you don't just get a background check when you buy a gun at a licensed dealer. If you sell a background check to someone you know or a stranger, you also have to do a background check there. And this was a huge contest in which national gun control and gun rights groups both poured a lot of money into Nevada. But the way the law was written asked that the FBI would conduct these background checks. And the FBI said, no, actually, the state system would be better. This is highlighting how difficult it is to get the right records actually in our background check system. And because of this administrative dispute, the Attorney General of Nevada, who had been against the law from the beginning, wrote an opinion saying that the law was unenforceable and that no one had to comply with it. And then went on to go to speak at the NRA's annual meeting where he was celebrated for making sure this law never became the law of the land. Extremely has been, from local reporting, very aggressive in touting his political record on this law. Meanwhile, the Department of Public Safety in Nevada is incredibly frustrated because they think these background checks would be helpful, and they want to escape this snafu, politicized snafu, and actually get these things done.
And you report that law enforcement officials have said that Paddock had no serious criminal record, which would mean that a background check probably wouldn't have flagged him as unfit to purchase a gun.
I think this is the real challenge with only having this conversation after events like this. The fact that Paddock was able to get his guns legally is not atypical of a lot of mass shooters. In Sandy Hook, the shooter stole the guns from his mother. But if you look more broadly at everyday gun violence in America, that's the place where a lot more guns are coming through illegal means, and where having a more rigorous background check system might help cut off the black market in illegal guns. And so if you use the lens of this day to try to say what we should do, you might be able to do something about these particular events. But the more than 10,000 people murdered with guns each year, you're not necessarily helping them.
Hmm.
The victims of these shootings are so terrible, but they make up such a tiny percentage of the overall toll of people being killed with guns in this country.
And what would you add to that, Shannon?
I would just say that, you know, when we reduced automobile deaths in this country,
Shannon, I think we're losing you there. Are you there, Shannon?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
You know, when you look at automobile deaths in this country, we didn't reduce them only by requiring people to wear seatbelts. It was a whole host of things. It was requiring airbags in cars and putting rumble strips on roads and putting standard speed limits in place. It was a whole host of measures, and we haven't tried any of those preventive measures with guns. Everything from background checks to gun safety technology to responsible storage laws. There's a whole host of things that we could try and that would work together, that have a symbiotic relationship, that we haven't even attempted.
What strikes you about how politicians respond after these shootings? There's some research out of the Harvard Business School that found, in terms of laws that are actually enacted, the impact of mass shootings depends on which party is in power. Well, that's not very surprising. But in states with Republican-controlled legislatures, a mass shooting increases the number of enacted laws that loosen gun restrictions by 75%. In Democratic-controlled legislatures, mass shootings have no significant effect on any laws enacted. What are your thoughts on that, Lois?
I think it's a great example of how we really have to start looking at these shootings, not only from the lens that we might typically do if we're living in San Francisco or New York, but understanding how gun owners see them in this very big country of ours. And I think what we often miss in the media coverage, which is almost always of these incredibly horrific events with guns, is the background of guns in America, which is that tens of millions of Americans own them and use them perfectly safely every day. That we like to say, oh my goodness, we have, you know, 300 million guns in America, and our rates of gun murder and gun suicide are just off the charts. Those things are both really true, and that correlation is a real one. But for the experience of gun owners every day on the ground, you know, they're not necessarily seeing that. They're using their guns safely. They're seeing their neighbors use their guns safely. They're not seeing a problem. If you do sort of a rough back-of-the-envelope calculation about the number of guns we have and the number of gun suicides and gun assaults and gun murders, less than 1% of America's guns are used in a crime every year, much smaller, like a tenth of a percent. So that understanding of safety, about guns being a tool that people use and like and that are relatively rarely abused, is something that we have to think about. And so that when you're living in a place where, like, everyone has guns and it's never been a problem, and you hear people from who live in a very different place than you, who may not know a lot about guns, who are trying to regulate them without really understanding them or without ever having shot one, there's an impulse to actually move forward and say, no, these rights are under attack unreasonably. I was in a town earlier this year, Nuqua, Colorado, who after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in 2012 passed a local ordinance saying that every family had to own a gun. So instead of passing gun control, they required gun ownership. And that was something of a joke in the town because they wanted to say, we think this debate is unreasonable, we think you don't understand us, and we want to show what our values actually are.
Well, I mean, it is odd when, for example, if you go to, I went to a gun show in Oklahoma City in 2005 and asked people selling semi-automatics how long it would take for me to get one, and they said about 3 days. And so that doesn't make sense to a lot of people. Or why, for example, was Stephen Paddock allowed to buy so many guns in such a small amount of time? He had a stockpile of over 42 guns.
I think what's, again, hard to realize is that if you don't own guns and you're like, and you hear someone has 42 guns, you might think, oh my goodness, that's totally crazy. How could anyone do that? But if you look at a very good survey done by Harvard and Northeastern researchers from last year, in fact, there's 7.7 million people in America who own between 8 and 140 guns, according to this survey. The average number that they own is 17 guns. So you might say, oh my gosh, that's a stockpile. Only, like, you could only have that many guns if you're planning an attack. That's just not true. There are millions of Americans who have this many guns, who have big collections, who like to shoot different things, who hunt different kinds of game, and they're going to get up to something like 40, and they're never going to hurt anyone, and they're never going to do anything wrong.
And Lois, when you interview people about this, what's the reasoning for owning semi-automatics?
So I think a semi-automatic is just a gun that fires one round with every pull of the trigger. Very typical, normal kind of gun. Many guns in America are semi-automatics. If you ask about something like more like a military-style rifle, these ones that are termed assault weapons and that were banned for 10 years, people just say that they're fun and they like them, and they argue that the functionality of a semi-automatic hunting rifle, which not that many people are getting up in arms about, or sort of a black AR-15 rifle, are mainly cosmetic. You can debate whether or not you think that is true, but I think the bigger picture is that rifles in general are used in something like 3.5% of gun murders each year by the FBI. That the weapons that show up in the most horrific mass casualty shootings that are very disturbing are dangerous. But if you look at the guns that are most likely to be abused, that are most likely to kill someone, that's a handgun.
That is Lois Beckett, senior reporter with The Guardian U.S., where she covers gun policy. We're also joined by Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And you can join us, 866-798-8255. You can also email. We have a new email, so please take note, yourcall@kalw.org. And let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. If I am a Republican member of Congress, and I confront the NRA, the NRA will finance an opponent in the next primary election, and I will be out of a job. The only way to deal with the NRA's power is public financing of elections. Until then, we're baying at the moon.
Well, it's a good point. The New York Times has a piece called Thoughts and Prayers and NRA Funding, and what they did is they grabbed quotes. So, for example, John McCain is the top recipient of NRA funding. Cindy and I are praying for the victims of the terrible shooting and their families, and according to the NRA, John McCain has received $7.7 million from the NRA. Richard Burr is number two on the list with almost $7 million. Shannon Watts, what about that?
Well, there's no doubt that the NRA has played a big role in our elections, every election, by deciding who they're going to give money to and who they won't. And an A rating from the NRA has been significant in terms of the amount they will contribute to your campaign. And what's interesting is that we've seen, even when Democrats vote the way they think the NRA wants them to in conservative states, the NRA still opposes them. So there really is no reason for Democrats to fear the NRA anymore, which I think is a good thing. But that is a lot of what we do as an organization. We demand that lawmakers explain their NRA rating from the NRA. Do they believe that?
Oh, did we lose you again, Shannon? Well, hopefully we can get Shannon back after the break. Shannon's on a cell phone. We have a link to this New York Times piece, and it found that The highest ranked Democrat in the House who's received money from the NRA is Sanford Bishop. He ranks 41st in career donations from the NRA. Among the top 100 House recipients, 95 are Republicans. And then in the Senate, the top two Dems are Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Patrick Leahy of Vermont. They rank 52 and 53 behind every Republican but Dan Sullivan of Alaska. And you can find that New York Times piece at yourcallradio.org. Shannon Watts is founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, and Lois Beckett is a senior reporter for The Guardian U.S. Today we are talking about guns, the NRA, and how to make sense of all these statistics that we now have access to, and we'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. Go to the telephone. You may send an email to yourcall@klw.org, or you may go to yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show, the lines are filling up, but our telephone number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. In one half hour, it's 1A with Joshua Johnson. His guests will talk about Puerto Rico, disaster, and debt. That's 1A with Joshua Johnson right after Your Call at 11 o'clock this morning here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow for our media roundtable, we will be joined by Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! He's out with a new book called Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. It's a really interesting book that looks at the impacts of neoliberal policies on urban spaces, why we are living now with so much inequality, and also how two decades of grassroots activism has produced progressive leaders around the globe, including San Juan Mayor's Carmen Yulin Cruz. So we'll speak with Juan Gonzalez tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us. We've got a new email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about guns, the NRA, how powerful it is, all of the statistics that we have, the importance of making distinctions between, for example, suicides, children who are killed by guns, and mass shootings. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think about the conversations you're hearing? What's missing? What would you like to add? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're joined today by Lois Beckett, senior reporter for The Guardian U.S., and Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Let's go next to Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise.
Hello, good morning. If I may just quickly also second the man who just spoke of publicly paid for elections, because I think the elections in this country are a disgrace, really. So, but that's not what I called to say. I wanted to mention that about a half a year ago or so, I listened to a program on the radio. I cannot tell you the people that were there, but there was a person from Switzerland being, he was speaking, and he said that in Switzerland, it can often take up to 9 months to do a background check.
Wow.
So they just have to wait, you know. And it seems almost amazing in this day, you know, with computers and all, but it's only 5 months since he said this. So,
yeah. So
I just wanted to mention that because people so often start talking about how every family in Switzerland must have a gun. And I think perhaps that's kind of outdated. So thank you for this program. We certainly need to do a lot.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Lois, when we have conversations about guns, gun restrictions, gun laws, countries with no guns are often brought into the conversation. What do you think about some of these comparisons? Australia also is often brought into the conversation.
I think Australia for Americans is a mirage. It's so easy to say Australia did something about its mass shootings. Why can't we? But what Australia did was essentially confiscate and melt down nearly 1 million weapons, about a third of the country's gun stock. For America to do a similar thing to what Australia did would mean confiscating and melting down something something like 90 million firearms. So I think it's really hard when Americans sort of propose doing things like Australia, they might not realize how serious it is, or the American assault weapon ban, which didn't show clear evidence of reducing violence, wasn't something where people had to give up the guns they already had. It was a ban on future manufacturing and future transfers, and it was a ban because of the way it was written that was fairly easy for gun companies to walk around. So again, there's this magical thinking with the gun debate in America where people are like, we know what to do. We can do this. Why don't we vote? Why is the NRA standing in the way? But the NRA is not actually standing in the way of any of these big policies that other countries did because Democrats aren't introducing them. So it's a bit unfair to keep criticizing Republicans for blocking legislation that could save so many lives when they're often blocking legislation that's actually pretty watered down to the point of where the effect of it is a little bit dubious.
Shannon, are you back with us?
I am.
Okay, what would you add to that? What are your thoughts on the comparison between the United States and other countries?
Well, I mean, the one thing that we aren't talking about in this discussion is the fact that we are the only developed nation with a gun lobby. That is what makes us very unique. We have a lot of guns and very few gun laws. And there's a reason for that. It's 30 years of the gun lobby being very involved in both federal and state legislation. And also, the NRA, the leaders themselves have become extremely radicalized. The positions they held in 1999, no guns in schools, a background check on every gun sale, completely out the window. And the reason for that is because they are selling more guns to fewer people. And they have become, I mean, if you look at their Twitter feed, if you look at the marketing materials they put out, they have become very radicalized, and their agenda is very much the same as Donald Trump's, which is creating a culture war so that our Americans are so afraid that they have to buy guns. And so that has absolutely impacted what Democrats can do, what Republicans feel they need to do, and the gun laws that are being introduced. All of that impacts it. And that's why, you know, we work very hard to make lawmakers separate themselves from the NRA and explain why they would defend such radical policies that do result in American lives being lost.
Can you elaborate on this a bit? In a couple of weeks, we're going to do a show about the culture of fear in this country. But can you talk more about that? The culture of fear, the culture of violence. According to that Huffington Post piece about the NRA running so many ads during the election in a lot of swing states, there were many ads of a woman sleeping alone in her bed, you know, and it's like a robber's coming and Hillary Clinton's going to take your gun away. So can you talk more about this culture of fear and culture of violence in this country, Shannon?
Well, first of all, the culture of fear, you know, fear sells. It makes people afraid, and then they feel like they have to buy a product to protect themselves. It's not based on data. It's based on anecdotal and marketing, frankly. And so that is how Donald Trump won the presidency, and the NRA was his largest outside donor with more than $30 million. And it's worked for the NRA for about a decade. They have been able to sell guns, you know, after Sandy Hook shooting. They made everyone afraid their guns would be confiscated, and their annual budget went up $100 million. Gun sales went through the roof, and so they prey usually on these mass shootings to increase gun sales. Now there is a Trump slump. Gun sales are down $100 million from this time last year because there's no boogeyman in the White House for the NRA to tell gun owners that your guns are going to be taken away. So what they have to do is make us afraid of each other. They have to foment a culture war. And that's what we see them do, and I do think that's why we're starting to see more success in this country is because we have gun safety advocates like Moms Demand Action who are saying, you know, you may be erroneously afraid your guns are going to be taken away, but we are afraid our children are going to be taken away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what motivates us. And so fear can motivate you to do many different things.
And it's related to Donald Trump saying that Mexicans are rapists, that the inner cities are full of violence. And this is connected to a comment from our next listener. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much. I just have one name to mention here, Philando Castillo, a black gun owner who was gunned down by police. I didn't hear the NRA defend his rights as a gun owner at all. So there's definitely a racial component to this. I really doubt that the multiple gun owners happen to be black. I believe that most of them, in the vast majority, are probably white Republicans. And I also feel that this is a public health issue. Just like just like police killings, without any kind of accountability, is a public health issue that makes black people and black men in particular fear for their lives in many parts of this country. It also becomes exacerbated during disaster, such as what happened during Katrina, where there were multiple gun owners running around in their pickup trucks targeting black men just because they were trying to survive during a disaster situation. So it's very it's a public health issue, and it's a threat to our democracy.
Well, thank you, Lisa. To your point about Philando Castile, I just pulled up a Washington Post story from 2016 called The NRA's Internal Split Over Philando Castile. And it says the NRA is facing internal divisions as its members argue that the group did not do enough to defend gun owners' rights by speaking out on behalf of Philando Castile of Falcon Heights, Minnesota, who was shot to death during a traffic stop. Philando Castile had a valid permit to carry a gun. He also reportedly informed the officer who shot him that he was armed in an attempt to head off a misunderstanding. What about this, Shannon? This got a lot of attention right after Philando Castile was shot and killed.
The NRA is suspiciously silent when black gun owners are shot and killed. And there's a reason for that. It goes against their overall marketing message and their demographic. If you look at their videos, if you look at their publications or their television channel, all they talk about are why you need to be armed, and it's usually to protect yourself from thugs, which is, you know, a not-so-subtle dog whistle. And they are absolutely marketing to a specific demographic. I mean, keep in mind, the NRA opposed open carry until 3 years ago when more radical gun groups demanded that they support open carry. And they were completely silent when white supremacists showed up with AR-15s in Charlottesville. So, you know, it is part of their MO, and I do think that it starts to create a division because eventually it will not represent the demographics of America.
These NRA videos got a lot of attention when they were released. Dana Loesch appears in these videos, and one of them, the NRA basically told the New York Times, quote, "We're coming for you." Can you talk more about these videos for people who haven't seen them or don't know about them? Shannon, did we lose you again?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I didn't know who you were asking. Yes. You know, what we've seen since Donald Trump was elected is a much more radicalized NRA that feels free to create and foment a culture war. And that's exactly what they're doing. When you don't have someone in the White House that you can say is going to confiscate your guns, then you have to make Americans afraid of one another in order to increase gun sales. And so they have to go after Hillary Clinton, who obviously did not win the election, but they still go after her all the time. They have to go after the media. And I think what's fascinating is if you look at the NRA TV Twitter feed, in the week before the tragedy in Las Vegas, it was all about how you can't kneel during the national anthem. Now, what that has to do with guns, I'm not sure of, but they've clearly decided that their best bet is to double down on a culture war and to echo the message of Donald Trump, and that is what is going to appease and appeal to their demographic.
And Lisa also had a comment about how this is a public health crisis. Lois, can you talk about what happened in 1996 when the U.S. government froze, in large part, federally funded research on gun violence and why this is so important?
Yes, so it is really important to acknowledge that even research, even counting deaths, is incredibly politically fraught. We like to share statistics, but that what we can know and what we can't know about gun violence or other charged issues are themselves political questions. We actually don't have really great estimates of how many people are shot in America each year and survive. At sometimes the estimates from different government agencies have been trending in different directions. And this isn't an accident. It means that we don't care enough about it. It means we're not devoting money to it. So what happened in 1996 is that there was an increasing amount of public money and attention towards public health research at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and elsewhere, looking at guns and the risk of having a gun in the home. And after one of these studies, which concluded it was actually more dangerous to have a gun in your home, it was more likely to be used against you than it was to be used in self-defense, the NRA really went on offense against research and against public health research in general, arguing that it was biased and that the government shouldn't be funding it. And they they succeeded in getting a budget rider, which didn't make it illegal for the CDC to fund gun violence prevention research, but made it pretty clear that that was dangerous and that their budget might be affected if they continued. So that did have an incredible chilling effect on public health researchers at the CDC. But it's also really important to know that public health research or the CDC isn't the only one looking at gun violence prevention. That often gets missed when telling this story, but the Justice Department has continued to fund research on gun violence prevention and violence prevention, and in fact has made a lot of progress in understanding how through policing and community efforts it's possible to dramatically reduce shootings. In the same year that CDC research on gun violence was cut off, there was researchers in Boston were understanding how to cut youth homicides there by 63%. And so what we don't recognize if we just talk about mass shootings, if we talk about everyday gun violence in Baltimore or Boston or Chicago, we've made a lot of progress in thinking about what police departments and communities can do to be more effective. And one of those things includes police departments actually working with Black community leaders and apologizing for failures in the past, whether that's police violence or just not being effective in addressing violence, and trying to start over and say, we don't want to criminalize people for the sake of it. We want to work with you and make sure that the community is safer. It's not about locking people up. It's about stopping the violence. And these efforts have been repeated over and over again, the Boston ceasefire model. It's very effective. And yet it's so strange that we don't talk about the police as part of this conversation on gun violence prevention, even though if you look at the cities and the neighborhoods that have the highest rates of gun murder in this country, they are places that have deeply troubled relationships with the police departments because of police violence. Right now in St. Louis, there are continuing protests over police brutality and the failure of police to protect Black citizens. And we're not talking about that. Even we're having a gun debate that leaves that out completely. And that's just crazy.
Well, we do lots of shows about that, but you're right. On this one, there's not much talk about police killings.
I mean, and I'm not saying that these issues don't get attention. It's
right.
Just so interesting and problematic that we see them as separate issues, as that police shooting citizens, when citizens are highly armed, when murders are going unsolved, that these are seen as sort of separate silos with separate advocates. I think one thing that's really interesting I've seen in Shannon's work and the gun violence prevention movement over the past couple of years is that they've begun to be a lot more intersectional in the way that they talk about violence and when they talk about the victims of violence. I think in recent years they've started to talk about police shootings of people as something that is a gun violence prevention problem, where for many years that just wasn't mentioned at all, perhaps because law enforcement were seen as allies you didn't want to alienate, and that's changing.
Shannon, can you talk about why that's changing? What do the conversations specifically around these issues sound like behind the scenes?
No, I think Lois is right. I mean, everything has become much more intersectional, I think, in the last couple of years. And yes, police are absolutely allies. And I think for a long time, gun violence prevention advocates thought, well, we are really supporting background checks, and that's not going to impact what police do. But then, you know, when you look at the data, you do realize that you really can't talk about gun violence without talking about racism and how that impacts who's shot in this country. And I would also, you know, I think the interesting thing about the police discussion as well is that lawmakers are completely disregarding the input of police officers who know better than anyone what is going to make their community safer. I mean, when you look at laws like guns on campus, police oppose those laws at the state level, and yet lawmakers disregard and sign these bills into law. When you look at the bills that Congress has been considering, silencers or concealed carry reciprocity, police have weighed in on those issues, and they have said this will make Americans less safe. This will make us as police less safe. And yet lawmakers are going ahead and pushing forward with those laws, and that's the crazy part.
What is the status of the silencer bill in the House? According to reports, Lois, Paul Ryan said that they're going to put it on hold for now.
This is such an interesting that this piece of legislation has been put on hold twice now. Before it was put on hold when Republican members of Congress, including Steve Scalise, were attacked at a congressional baseball practice outside of Washington, D.C. This is a piece of legislation that gun manufacturers are excited about this as potentially opening up a market for silencers or suppressors, and that would be a new stream of revenue when people have already bought up a lot of guns and maybe have as many guns as they might want right now. But yet it keeps running afoul of increasingly horrible mass shootings.
There have been conflicting reports about what silencers actually do. Can you tell us how they work?
So I think the argument is people think of silencers from movies. They think that they silence the gun completely, and folks who are gun rights activists say, no, it's better to call them suppressors, that while it does reduce the noise, it's not enough that you would be concerned about it, and that this would be useful for hearing protection for people who are shooters.
Well, thank you for that call, Lisa. Let's go next to Tonman in Alameda. Hi, Tonman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. When I hear the argument that it's for hunting or a hobby or entertaining to own guns, even assault rifles and automatic weapons, I'm thinking about even the ludicrous open carry legislation allowing in church and in universities carrying guns. I think there's a critical resistance here, a critical intersection of this crisis with the violence and guns in this country. I want your panel to address Charlottesville, where we witness white supremacists marching to the tune of Donald Trump's campaign to exclude Muslims and Mexicans, and they were all carrying, not all, but a lot of them were carrying weapons.
Yes, thank you for that. What about that, Shannon? Some of the people we saw on the streets had more arms. They were more heavily armed than the police officers on the streets.
Yeah, and that's what several people in Virginia state government pointed out. You know, open carry is legal in 45 states in this country, and these laws are largely, you know, very lax. Open carry is mostly unregulated, and the reason is it's because, you know, people didn't think when they passed these laws that you would take your AR-15 and go shop at Kroger. They, you know, these were mainly pertaining to hunting rifles. And so what we've seen gun extremists do is to say, you know, and they say this, a right not exercised is a right not had, right? And so they feel they have to walk up and down the street either with open carrying handguns, and having lived in both Midwest and Colorado, you see people with handguns loosely in their pockets all the time, or they carry assault rifles. And here in Colorado, where I live, a couple of years ago, a man was walking up and down the street, and someone called 911, and the operator said, look, that's perfectly legal. And then he shot and killed four people. I think it's an absurd law. It certainly doesn't belong in urban areas of our country or in public places. And it is being exploited, and it's being used to silence and intimidate people. I mean, how can you feel like you have the right to free speech when someone who's at a rally has an AR-15? It's absurd, and it is really something that should be regulated.
Shannon, what went through your mind after the Sandy Hook horrific shootings that left 20 children killed? So many of us thought, okay, children were killed. Something has to happen. Again, this happened in 2012, and nothing happened. And at that point, a lot of people said, we're lost. If you can't pass laws after children are gunned down, when will you?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up, because there's nothing that makes me more angry than the cynicism I see after shootings like Las Vegas, when people say, look, nothing happened after Sandy Hook, so nothing will, and kind of throw up their hands. It's absolutely not true. I mean, in many ways, when you're doing activism, the work starts in the states and it ends in Congress. The idea that this Congress beholden to the gun lobby was somehow going to change their tune overnight was unrealistic. But what did happen after Sandy Hook was the largest grassroots movement ever for gun violence prevention. And we have passed, you know, Lois mentioned this earlier, we are winning in the states. We've closed the private sale loophole in 7 states. More than 50% of all Americans now live in states that have closed the private sale loophole. We've passed laws in 24 states to keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. And just as importantly, we've stopped hundreds of bad bills that would have sailed through state houses. Permitless carry, guns on college campuses, guns in K-12 schools, expanding Stand Your Ground. Mm-hmm. Every year we show up in state houses and kill those bills. So much has happened. And look, I wished Hillary Clinton had been elected. She made gun violence prevention a huge part of her policy platform. We're just going to have to play defense and kill the silencer bill, kill concealed carry reciprocity bill, and keep fighting in the states until we have a Congress and a president who will do the right thing.
Lois, you've interviewed a number of the parents who lost children during the Sandy Hook shootings. You interviewed a few just recently. What are they telling you? And talk a little bit about the work that they're doing right now.
So I think if you can imagine how frustrated you feel as an individual watching the same debate play out over and over again, and you know, at the national level, things not changing, to be a parent of a child who was killed in these shootings and to see not only the shootings keep going and get bigger and claim the lives of more people and the same talking points happen after each one. I spoke to Nicole Hockley earlier this week, and it makes her incredibly angry. But she also said that, you know, apathy is not an option here, and just to give up or to say that just because gun control laws aren't passing in Congress that means we can't do anything is ridiculous and it's ignorant, that there are many ways to tackle this. There are in the state, there are working with police departments to be more effective, local governments to be more effective, mental health, there are legal options, that when you're talking about violence, that it has so many like broad roots, and there are so many ways to actually help people save lives. In fact, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is a big gun industry trade group, very quietly started working on a suicide prevention initiative late last year, trying to work with gun owners, people who are really pro-gun, but to talk about how to prevent gun suicide, how to help your friends when you think that they're at risk, how to intervene in the right way. So that it's easy to be frustrated or to think that this issue is not moving, but that's false. Actually, Oakland has seen a dramatic decline in its murders over the past couple of years. At the same time, where advocates have really been working to try to do the most effective, most data-driven strategies for helping and intervening with the people at risk. And people are like people in the gun industry, gun store owners are working on gun suicide. So there's actually lots of progress that's happening and lots of alliances that are being built that just totally gets ignored in this endless culture war, in this endless battle between people at the two extremes.
And Shannon, final thoughts from you. We have an email from Karen who says, rather than just documentaries and education, why don't we have powerful anti-gun lobbies like the NRA has? And your group is working with a number of other groups.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're not anti-gun. We support the Second Amendment. A lot of our volunteers are gun owners, or they're married to gun owners. But we do believe that with rights come responsibilities. And we have over 60,000 active volunteers. We have 4 million supporters. We have become a powerhouse in state legislatures, and we're also changing corporate policy. So I do think that we have learned how to become the David to the NRA's Goliath, but this is going to take time. This is a marathon, not a sprint. It's going to take several election cycles to change out lawmakers, to change laws. I mean, just last week, I was in Rhode Island with the governor, and where she signed a domestic gun violence bill into law that we had been fighting for 3 years, and the NRA fought us every step of the way. This work takes time, but we are doing it, finally.
I also want to mention that a GoFundMe account has raised over $8 million for the victims of the mass shooting in Las Vegas. Unfortunately, a lot of people are in such a bind when these things happen because they don't have adequate health care, and so they have to go on GoFundMe. And this particular account has raised over $8 million for people who were shot and hurt in Las Vegas. And you can find more information about that online. Shannon Watts is founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, and Lois Beckett is a senior reporter for The Guardian U.S., where she covers these issues. Shannon and Lois, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW. You can sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Sanaa Saleem for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.